projects happening. We've got some time, we've got some lead time, but that's going to disappear very, very quickly.
President of the Gasline Corporation says he is done preaching to non-believers. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 10th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, a longtime Fairbanks representative is stepping down from the legislature.
My health is fine, has nothing to do with my decision. I have no legal matters hanging over my head, right? You're not going to hear something come down later on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Since taking the lead on the Gasline project 2 years ago, the Walker administration has doggedly pursued its plan for the megaproject. In the process, they've chalked up some successes, including interest from China's president and a tentative agreement with BP. So are Alaskans finally convinced the Gasline is going to get built? Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk went to a public meeting on the project in Anchorage last night and has this report.
The state-owned Alaska Gasline Development Corporation has been traveling across the state, holding meetings with the public to pitch the Gasline project and answer questions. During the Anchorage meeting, there were moments that felt less like a discussion about a complex infrastructure project and more like a revival.
All right, who's feeling inspired? Let's go build this. Woo!
That's AGDC Communications Manager Jesse Carlstrom, warming up the crowd of nearly 200 Alaskans. A lot of the clapping and cheering came from a big cluster of people in orange shirts, all union workers. After explaining the project's progress so far, AGDC President Keith Meyer called out a series of questions.
You can either tell me yes or you can tell me no. Don't hem and haw. You can say it loud. Will Alaskans have preference in hiring?
Yes. Yes.
Will there be a project labor agreement?
Yes.
AGDC estimates that building the gas line from Prudhoe Bay to Nikiski would result in close to 12,000 jobs at peak construction. They'll need carpenters, ironworkers, teamsters, welders, and more. But despite its economic promise for Alaska, the project has endured a lot of skepticism, from energy analysts to the legislature to, as Meyer has a habit of saying, the headlines. But now, Meyer told the crowd, he's done preaching to the non-believers.
We're not doing that anymore. Now the message is to the believers that, hey, we got to get ready.
Sitting in the audience before the meeting, Christopher Coleman Denemy said he's ready to get to work. He was one of the guys in the orange shirts, a member of Labor's Union Local 341.
I'm seeing everything lining up and taking place, and it's really exciting for everybody.
Coleman Denemy says it took some time, but he's become one of the Gasline believers.
When I first heard about this, I was a little skeptical because my parents had said that this had been talked about for years, but nothing has been moved forward like it has now, so everything's falling into place, and it's going to create a lot of jobs for everybody, and I'm going to be a part of that.
But there are still Alaskans who aren't sold. Outside the meeting, a lone protester who refused to give his name paced the sidewalk with a sign reading Alaska's Biggest Boondoggle Yet and the words LNG Gasline crossed out in red. And during the meeting, some attendees aired concerns about China's involvement in the project and questioned whether it can pencil out. That included Stan Porhola. He thinks BP's tentative agreement to sell the gas is encouraging.
But I'm still very skeptical that this project can go through. Basically, who's going to invest in this project, how much it's going to cost, and making sure that you move past the letters of intent and actually getting to actual sale agreements to the different countries.
Porhola works in the oil and gas industry. He says he'd definitely benefit if the megaproject comes to fruition. But he says Alaskans need to make sure that the project is truly a good deal for the state. And before Porhola becomes another Gasline believer, there's a long list of questions he needs answered. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The Alaska Senate voted today to end a key requirement of the criminal justice reform voted into law 2 years ago. It would end a mandate that low and moderate risk misdemeanor defendants be released without posting cash bail. Now, judges will be able to order bail for all defendants. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman was on the Senate floor for the vote.
Since January, people charged with misdemeanors who are assessed as having a low or moderate risk have been released without having to post cash bail. Anchorage Republican Senator Mia Costello proposed allowing judges to require the cash bail for all defendants, not just those assessed as being high risk.
And I heard from many, many Alaskans who said they are frustrated when the criminal who victimized them is caught, only to be immediately released, and then there are additional victims.
The Senate voted 12-6 in support of Costello's proposal. She says judges should have discretion to decide who is released without posting bail.
Public safety is our number one priority. There is no other issue that I'm hearing from my constituents on that is more important than this one. Families in Alaska want to be safe, and businesses want to get back to doing business instead of fending off criminals.
North Pole Republican Senator John Coghill opposed the proposal. He notes that those charged with felonies, sex offenses, or driving under the influence are not eligible for mandatory release. And those who violated the conditions of their release in the past also aren't eligible.
So what we're trying to do is actually free the judges up to deal with the people who are actually the ones that need the attention the most.
Coghill says the state is already seeing benefits from the change in pretrial decisions that happened in January. Judges are required to use a tool that looks at publicly available information to score the defendant's risk of failing to appear or commit another crime. Coghill says that giving judges more discretion sounds good, but releasing more defendants avoids problems.
It lets people go back to work. It actually solves a problem of not having to jail them, but it also solves a problem of not having recriminalization become part of their life.
It was an amendment to a larger criminal justice bill. The bill started as a measure allowing police officers to arrest people without warrants for assault on healthcare providers. But the Senate added several other proposals from Governor Bill Walker's administration. They include allowing judges to consider defendants' out-of-state histories in making pretrial decisions. And the Attorney General would be able to schedule new street drugs using emergency regulations. The bill heads over to the House. If the House agrees to the changes, it would go to Governor Walker's desk. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaska was among the states targeted by Russian-linked cyber actors ahead of the 2016 elections. The state had previously disclosed that there'd been some meddling, but a recent article in the Anchorage Daily News uncovered new details about a second effort targeting the state's election system. I'm joined on the line by ADN reporter Nathaniel Herz, who broke the story and is in Juneau covering the legislative session. Nat, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Your article goes deep into detail about how this hack happened, but in broad terms, what took place?
Yeah, so Election Day 2016, there's this Twitter account at CyberZeist that basically got sort of inside a server that is the server that powers Alaska's like public-facing elections page. And they basically got into that server in a way that they were not supposed to, that basically gave them administrator privileges, which is sort of the power to see and access whatever is on that server, not just sort of what is supposed to be a public document in that server. And then they also did a Twitter post from this Twitter account that suggested that they had the ability to change elections related web pages, specifically like, you know, adding a name to the list of candidates for, you know, governor or legislature or whatever. So the state is saying, yes, this happened. They had to report it to the FBI, which apparently went and reported it to a federal judge in turn. But they're saying, essentially, we didn't feel the need to tell anyone about it because it did not affect the integrity of the election in any way. And these are just folks that are looking for attention. And if they are not actually affecting the integrity of the election, why would we give them the attention and sort of make everyone worry about the integrity of the election and undermine their confidence?
Your article cites cybersecurity experts who say this attack actually failed. One of them even said, I'm quoting here, "This is just a glorious example of things working." What did he mean by that?
Well, I think basically what he means is, on the one hand, the hacker can accurately claim that sort of they hacked Alaska's election system. But what does that mean? It's sort of like you can, I guess, successfully claim that you broke into somewhere if you got through a screen door that's normally supposed to be padlocked and wasn't padlocked. But if the only thing on the screen porch is like election results that everyone had access to anyway, and all the jewels and the treasure is held inside a locked vault inside the house, you know, that's essentially what cybersecurity experts sort of told me here, is that the really sensitive stuff and the stuff that matters to Alaska's election, it was not really placed at risk here because state elections officials basically have insulated it.
And lastly, did this incident prompt any changes in the election system? Anything going forward that'll be done differently as a result?
You know, they say they're doing better cooperation with federal agencies, and they also are taking a step where they, in the past, if you live overseas, you've been allowed to return a ballot by email, and that's a process that at least one set of experts says is sort of notoriously insecure, and DOE is saying we're not. You know, this year, because of the threats that we're facing, we're not going to do that anymore.
Okay. Nathaniel Herz covers the legislature and all things Alaska politics for the Anchorage Daily News. Nat, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, UAF selected for new transportation pilot program.
For drone applications in agriculture, in commerce, in healthcare, and even human transportation.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the Federal Plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Longtime Fairbanks Democratic lawmaker David Guttenberg has decided against running for re-election to an eighth term in the Alaska House of Representatives. Guttenberg says he's leaving his decades of service to his district and the state party so that he can enjoy life at his home in Goldstream Valley. KYC's Tim Ellis reports.
Guttenberg says in his usual straightforward manner that he wants to dispense with the usual speculation that ensues whenever a politician announces he or she has decided to leave elected office.
Let me get a couple things out of the way, right? My health is fine, has nothing to do with my decision. I have no legal matters hanging over my head, right? You're not going to hear something come down later on.
The 66-year-old Guttenberg was hospitalized earlier this year for chest pains, but he says his reasons have nothing to do with that nor anything political. Instead, he says they have everything to do with just going back to his home in the Goldstream Valley and enjoying life.
It's time for me to step out, for me to just catch up on my personal life. The house is continually being remodeled and not finished because of all the other special sessions. My gardens have been neglected.
Guttenberg is still in Juneau for yet another of those extended legislative sessions, made longer by ongoing disagreement over putting together a state budget that'll pay for the services Alaskans demand, but that also will satisfy Republicans' demands for more spending cuts.
People want to, you know, talk about cutting the budget, but at the same time, they want services. You know, and they want the full PFD. And to get people all of those things is very difficult now.
Despite the rancor of the annual budget ordeal, Guttenberg says he feels good about playing a role in helping pass many important pieces of legislation during his 16 years representing the 4th District, which sprawls north and west of the city. Before redistricting, he represented the 8th District. He says he's especially proud of his years-long effort to get a veterans cemetery for Fairbanks.
This summer, they're actually going to do the groundbreaking for that.
Another major accomplishment, he says, was helping get both the House and Senate to unanimously pass a so-called PDM, or prescription drug manager, legislation.
A significant piece of healthcare legislation that will drive down prescription drug prices and keep our local pharmacies in place.
He says his disappointments include not being able to persuade his fellow lawmakers to do more about the lack of broadband internet connectivity in many places around the state. Guttenberg's been involved in Alaska politics since 1986, when he became treasurer of the Interior Democrats. He was elected chair the next year and went on to serve as chair of the state Democratic Party and national committeeman. He was scheduled to officially announce his decision to leave office during a meeting of the Laborers Union Local 942. That's an appropriate setting, says Mindy O'Neill, the present chair of the Interior Democrats.
David Guttenberg has been a great advocate for the interior. He's been a great advocate for labor and working people in education for the last 16 years. And we sure have been lucky up here to have his representation for that long.
O'Neill says because of his service, no other Democrat has challenged Guttenberg over the years. But she anticipates there'll be a fair amount of interest in the 4th District seat now that the longtime occupant is leaving it for a long-delayed home renovation project. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Pharmacists in Alaska this week are celebrating the passage of a bill making changes to prescription drug benefits and how businesses are reimbursed for that medication. The legislation was opposed by health insurers and the companies they hire to oversee pharmacy drug sales. From Petersburg, Joe Viknicki reports.
It's another busy morning at Petersburg Rexall Drugstore as pharmacist Kate Kowalski and two employees answer phones and fill prescriptions. It's the day after the passage of House Bill 240 in the Senate, and Kowalski says she's elated after trying with other pharmacists to get it passed for about a decade. The change that impacts her business the most will give the state the authority to decide appeals on the reimbursement that pharmacies receive for medication.
I mean, we've been getting squeezed and squeezed for years, and even to the point where it's not covering the cost of what we pay for these drugs. And so when you try to appeal them, we had no recourse. We would send things in. They would say, oh, yes, this is how you do it, but we would never get anything back. No.
Insurance providers hire companies called pharmacy benefit managers for this medication reimbursement and other oversight. Those PBMs, as they're called, have had the authority to negotiate drug prices between insurers and pharmacies and decide appeals. House Bill 240 creates a more transparent appeal process for pharmacies disputing reimbursements. It also gives the state's Division of Insurance a final say in disputes. Cindy Laubacher of Express Scripts, a national pharmacy benefit management company headquartered in St. Louis, testified before the Senate's Finance Committee April 20th. She outlined multiple problems she saw in the legislation. She also told the committee it was a huge concern to turn over appeal authority to the state.
We have appeals processes. We are happy to sit down and talk about creating an appeals process in statute that makes sense, that is fair for everyone. But we would say that handing the state the authority to make, taking that authority away from our clients and giving it to the state to make reimbursement decisions is hugely problematic for us and for our clients.
Laubacher explained her company was not trying to put community pharmacies out of business, but small independent businesses say they are being forced to close. Alaska Pharmacists Association Legislative Co-Chairman Barry Christensen of Ketchikan told the committee the group has seen a 25% decrease in independently owned community pharmacies. He thought PBMs played a big role in those closures. That association supported the legislation, as did the state's Board of Pharmacy. Legislators were convinced to make changes in the pricing practices. On the Senate floor, Anchorage Republican Kathy Giesel gave the example of Tamiflu used to treat influenza.
Wholesale distributors, in this example, in last year, was selling Tamiflu for about $58 for a prescription. But the PBMs were reimbursing the pharmacy $20 for that prescription. So every time a pharmacy dispensed Tamiflu, they were losing $38. There's not many businesses that can stay in business with that kind of loss, Mr. President.
Supporters of the bill say PBMs have prohibited pharmacies from mailing prescription medications to rural parts of the state. Backers also say they've not allowed a pharmacist to tell a customer if there's a less expensive option for a medication if a customer opts to pay out of pocket. The legislation prohibits the mailing restriction and the so-called gag rule for cheaper options in contracts between PBMs and pharmacies. It also seeks to create more reasonable procedures for PBMs auditing pharmacies, and it requires the companies to register with the state. The bill was opposed by the trade association, America's Health Insurance Plans. That organization wrote it will increase the cost of medication. Insurance companies say PBMs help prevent fraud and keep medication costs down. Health insurer Aetna opposed the bill. The legislation was sponsored by Fairbanks Democrat David Guttenberg and had legislators signing on as sponsors from both sides of the aisle. It passed unanimously in the House in April and the Senate earlier this month and goes next to the governor for his signature. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. 4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Work on a $46 million project to expand the state's largest hydroelectric facility is set to begin today. The Battle Creek Project, as it's known, will increase the Bradley Lake Hydro Facility's production by about 10%. The facility, which sits about 30 miles northeast of Homer at the head of Kachemak Bay, supplies wholesale power for 6 electric utilities throughout the rail belt. The project will divert glacial runoff via a 1.7-mile-long pipeline to the Bradley Lake Dam. Alaska Energy Authority manages the state-owned facility. AEA spokesperson Katie Conway says the project will produce an additional 37,000 megawatt hours per year.
If you use an average consumption of about 600 kilowatt hours per month per household would be enough power for a community roughly the size of the city of Homer for a year.
The 2-year project requires a road to be built along the pipeline. Conway says crews will begin blasting away rock along the route this week. AEA expects the road to be completed in October.
This construction season is about building the road. Next year, a water line goes in, and the project is expected to be completed in about August of 2020.
The Homer, Chugach, and Matanuska Electric Associations and the City of Seward have signed on to purchase power from the project. During construction season, an existing road near the Bradley Lake Dam will be closed. Some bear hunters use the road to access hunting grounds in the area, but Conway says its closure should not be a major inconvenience. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has been selected to participate in a federal program exploring the integration of unmanned aircraft into U.S. airspace. UAF's Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration is one of 10 entities selected from around the nation for the pilot program. At an event to announce the recipients in Washington, D.C. yesterday, U.S. Secretary of Transportation Elaine Chao said President Trump created the pilot program to facilitate testing of drones in conditions where they're not currently allowed to operate under.
These include operations over the heads of people, beyond the line of sight, and at night.
Chao says the United States Department of Transportation received 150 proposals, from which the winning 10 were selected.
The projects announced today will help open the door for drone applications in agriculture, in commerce, in healthcare, in emergency response, disaster assistance, and even human transportation.
Alaska Center Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration Director Kathy Cahill attended the event in Washington, D.C., and afterwards outlined a range of Alaska projects included in the UAF proposal.
Infrastructure monitoring for pipelines, including taps. We've got projects identified that will do medical device delivery, across the Turnagain Arm and marine mammal surveys in Cook Inlet, flying over Anchorage in that airspace for filming of events and for law enforcement. And we're looking at more remote regions and doing, you know, fish and wildlife surveys, wildfire monitoring, search and rescue.
Cahill says selection for the program cements Alaska's position as a national leader in drone testing and applications.
We have the test site. We are part of the FAA Center of Excellence in Research. And we have the integration pilot program. We're one of only two states that has all three, so we've got the triple crown.
Cahill says UAF has 21 project partners, including state agencies and private businesses, to help fund its various drone projects, as the federal pilot program does not come with any money. A new animated children's series debuting on PBS Kids next summer will feature an Alaska Native character in the title role, Molly of Denali. It's the first nationally distributed children's series to feature an Alaska Native character in a leading role. KTOO's Adeline Baxter has more.
The show stars 10-year-old Molly Mabray living in a fictional Alaskan village. She helps her parents run the Denali Trading Post General Store and Bunkhouse and goes on adventures with her dog and friends. PBS announced the new series on Wednesday at its annual meeting. WGBH Boston is co-producing the series with Atomic Cartoons. Alaska Native advisors and consultants have been brought in, and the goal is to also use Alaska Native voice talent and scriptwriters. Princess Dajrai Johnson, a Gwich'in Athabascan producer who lives in Fairbanks, is the creative producer for the series. Juneau resident and University of Alaska Southeast professor Cooney Lance Twitchell is a language advisor for the program.
The idea is throughout the course of these episodes, there'll be several Alaska Native languages that are featured and trying to utilize that to create a teaching platform for exposure, normalization, and so our kids can see it on the television.
The show is designed for children ages 4 to 8. It focuses on literacy education. Molly uses books, historical archives, and oral histories from elders to explore her world. Some of her adventures may bring her to Southeast Alaska.
The idea is that she would travel, and she has relatives and friends in various parts of Alaska. And so also just trying to be conscious of making sure that we've got accurate representations.
Twitchell studies and teaches Tlingit and works actively to promote Indigenous languages in Alaska. He said he and other advisors for the show hope it will open more doors for Alaska Native representation on television.
I've shared a vision with Princess that eventually there's more and more content that's not just featuring Alaska Native languages, but that's the medium, is Alaska Native languages. And I believe that this is a step to help us move in that direction.
The series is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Department of Education's Ready to Learn grant, and the CBC. 38 half-hour episodes and 1-hour-long special are currently in production. The show will air on the PBS Kids channel and digital platforms. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.